From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The first of the month when rent checks are due, but amid the economic upheaval due to the coronavirus, some Granite Staters may struggle to pay rent, even with stimulus checks and expanded unemployment benefits. Under the current state of emergency, Governor Sununu has put a moratorium on evictions while encouraging tenants to work with their landlords to avoid owing back rent. But eventually, property owners will have to be paid. And on their end, many landlords are worried about what rights they have in these uncertain times. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Are you a tenant concerned about making rent? Or what happens once the emergency orders are lifted? Are you a landlord wondering about your income or the safety of your property? Send us your questions and experiences to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Brian Shaughnessy is with us, an attorney who works in landlord-tenant disputes and president of the New Hampshire Bar Association's pro bono program. Also with us, Elliot Berry, managing attorney with New Hampshire Legal Assistance, where he's co-director of the Housing Justice Project. And also with us, Alyssa Margolin, director of Housing Action NH, a coalition focused on affordable housing in the Granite State. And Alyssa, I want to start with you. One major short-term impact of the coronavirus that we've heard about a lot recently is renters. People are out of work and may struggle to pay their rent. That's short-term. What is the biggest long-term concern that you have, Alyssa, about the way the pandemic is going to impact rental housing?
Well, thank you, Laura, for having me. Thank you for this important question. It's true. We are headed for the perfect storm around housing instability and a potential surge in evictions and in homelessness. Before the COVID pandemic, we had half of our renter population cost burdened, meaning they were struggling to pay the cost of their monthly rent. Add to that the unemployment, add to that the moratorium, where we've seen somewhere between 17 and 30% of renters unable to pay their monthly rent. We could find most of our renter population owing back rent, very frustrated property owners unable to collect. So this is a really important topic today.
Wow. So perfect storm of housing instability and homelessness. Why, Alyssa, do you think that property owners might also be struggling? They don't get their rent. Do you think some of them will shut down their properties?
I think that we need to think about policy and resource solutions that'll help property owners with their stabilities. You know, our coalition, Housing Action New Hampshire, is made up of 80 organizations, and most of them are multifamily housing providers. It's not really one side or the other. It's a system that that needs each other. So to the extent that we can provide rental assistance, for example, to renters who need it, who have been impacted by the pandemic, and to the extent that we can provide assurances and protections for our property owners and our multifamily housing providers, hopefully we can provide some stability and weather the upcoming storm.
Yeah, stability on both ends of the agreement, so to speak. Elliot, how about you? When coronavirus cases began to rise, the economy began to shut down, what immediate concerns went through your mind, Elliot, given the work that you've been doing for a long time?
Well, I mean, the most immediate concern is how on earth are tenants going to be able to pay their rent. Just to add one statistic, we have, by last count, there were over 30,000 households, tenant households in the state of New Hampshire, where they were paying over 50% of their income for rent, which means one unexpected loss of income or one unexpected expense means you're very, very close to eviction. So now you take tens of thousands of people who no longer have any work or whose hours have been cut way, way back. And it's a what we're looking at is a tsunami of eviction cases when this is all over.
So you said 30,000 Granite Staters pay more than 50% of their income for rent. Elliot, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the comfortable level is said to be, or sustainable level is said to be 30%, right? That's about how much you're supposed to be spending on housing.
Exactly. So it's a severe overburden when you're up over 50%, and it's unsustainable.
Brian, how about you? What landlord concerns have come up? What have you heard about with all of this, you know, enormous economic upheaval that our other guests have talked about, but also a highly infectious disease?
Well, let me start with that last one, with the highly infectious disease. The issues that have been popping up within the past couple of weeks is I'll get calls from my management companies or owners, and they're asking, well, if I have a tenant or I've heard this tenant is positive, do I have a duty to do something? Do I have a duty to warn the other tenants in the building? And, you know, should we be posting it, and should we be naming the people? And so that's been a very difficult thing for the landlords to negotiate. And my advice to them has been to, you know, post a notice out there, not identifying the tenant, obviously. There may be some HIPAA concerns, not that the landlords are covered by HIPAA, but there's some privacy concerns. And just to warn the other tenants to take extra precaution in the common areas, you know, such as wiping down things or washing their hands. With respect to the landlords on the other side, the immediate concern was exactly as you've portrayed it to be, is what's going to happen when the tenants can't pay the rent? Am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? But fortunately, the moratoriums that are in place with respect to a landlord doing eviction also are in place with respect to doing foreclosures. And many of the banks have been very, very good with talking to the landlords that owe, you know, money on their mortgage to try to do some type of forbearance, waiving late fees. So the crush for the landlord side of it really hasn't come yet. We're only 1 month in, if you will, since the moratorium. But I have a lot of nervous landlords, you know, for May and June.
Okay, and I definitely want to ask you, Brian, more about that moratorium, because that is key. But I am really interested in what the landlord's rights and responsibilities are, Brian, when somebody in a multifamily building is diagnosed with COVID-19. So what does a landlord have to do? Let's say he or she owns a building with, you know, 10 apartments and one of them has a COVID case. What does that landlord have to do?
Well, there's no statute out there that says that you have to do anything. There is no, you know, this is unprecedented, but with other infectious diseases, there is no guidance in any type of law that I'm aware of, federal or state. So a landlord attorney really has to analyze it as a negligence case. And a negligence case is a simple car accident case where somebody has a duty to stop at a stop sign and goes through the stop sign. They can be sued for damages. So on a landlord's side, if it snowed, you know, last night, you need to make sure you get salt, sand, and because you have knowledge of a dangerous situation. So the way I've analyzed it is if a landlord knows that there are tenants in a multi-unit building that have COVID-19, that may raise to the level of having a duty to do something to protect the other tenants from a dangerous situation. Now, on the flip side of that, with respect to a negligence, I don't want to scare all the landlords out there. I mean, you may have a duty to do something, but that doesn't mean that they have the ability to sue you, because everybody knows about COVID-19 in general.
Right.
But a prudent landlord, you know, using a negligence type of analysis, would go and just post it, as I said, in the common area, saying, you know, there may be somebody, you don't have to say there is or identify them, obviously, but there may be somebody who is positive for COVID-19, take these precautions. And I've helped a couple landlords, you know, revise their notices that they've posted at their apartment complexes.
Wow. Yeah. And I can see that for privacy concerns, you wouldn't want to say, you know, Susan Smith in apartment 2B has COVID-19. But it sounds like you're saying, Brian, landlords should inform residents that COVID-19 is present or could be present. I'm not really sure.
Yes, I would say to my clients to post a letter. It's like a warning letter. It's like a putting a yellow sign in the McDonald's with a wet floor after it's been mopped, just warning somebody of a danger that you know to exist, and for them to take precautions in order to avoid that. Now, the flip side of that argument for some attorneys out there listening who say, oh, no, don't do that, is there's another concept in the law. If you don't really have a duty to act, but you undertake the duty to act, kind of like a Good Samaritan law, you are then exposing yourself to legal liability. I don't see that type of exposure in a situation like that, putting up a sign and warning other people that there may be an infectious person in the common areas, they should take extra precaution. I don't really see how that can come back, and somebody could argue that, well, you didn't do enough. You needed to fumigate and do whatever. I can see somebody arguing, well, if you know there's COVID-19 in your building, you better make sure you're going in and disinfecting the common areas and doing those types of things. And I think that would be a prudent thing for landlords to do. If they know it's present in the building, they should take extra precautions to go in and wiping down the common areas and taking precautions.
Well, today in The Exchange, again, we're talking about landlord-tenant rights and relations, given all the economic upheaval due to the coronavirus, and also some of the health concerns that Brian is talking about. And Exchange listeners, we'd really love to hear from you. If you're a tenant concerned about making rent, or what happens once this moratorium is lifted, or if you're a landlord wondering about your income, the safety of your property, again, we'd love to hear your questions and personal experiences. You can send them in at exchange@nhpr.org. That's our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Elliot, this moratorium has come up a couple times, and I'd really like to clarify for our listeners what this moratorium said renters could do and what they could not do, Elliot.
Well, in terms of what the renters should could do and should do, nothing's changed. If it is all possible, they should pay their rent when they can. And if they can't pay all of it, try to communicate with their landlord and try to work out an arrangement where they can make it partial payments and create a repayment schedule over time. What the moratorium focuses on is what the landlord can't do. And simply enough, for now, a landlord cannot bring an eviction action in the court. They can't, under the executive order of the governor, they can't initiate an action. Under the Supreme Court's order, the court won't process an eviction case or set it down for hearing. The governor's executive order expires this Friday, as I understand it. However, even I suspect it'll be renewed in some way, shape, or form. But even regardless of whether it expires, the Supreme Court, the Circuit Court order is it's not going to begin taking eviction cases again or scheduling hearings until after May 6th.
Oh, okay. So, Elliot, just clarify for me. Yeah, because I thought that the moratorium was that tenants couldn't be evicted for lack of rent payment, but if they were breaking the law or damaging the dwelling, they could still be evicted. So I've got that wrong?
Right. So here, the initial order was no evictions at all. In Executive Order 24, it was modified so that evictions could go forward where a tenant was substantially damaging the premises or involved in behavior that substantially it has a substantial adverse impact on the health and safety of other tenants. Notwithstanding that modification, as of at least the last I heard, and I'm almost sure this is correct, the court still is not scheduling any hearings and won't till after May 4th. So the bottom line is right now, eviction actions are not happening and will not until after May 4th. I'd strongly suspect that after that time, the courts will be handling and scheduling either by phone or in person. They will be scheduling hearings where the reason for the eviction is something that the tenant has seriously done wrong or something they shouldn't do.
Yeah, something that endangers the safety of other tenants, but not for lack of payment, Elliot. That sounds like what you're expecting.
That's right.
Alyssa, what else do you think is important to know about this moratorium?
I think that it's important to be planning now for the crisis that is really just ahead. So once the moratorium is lifted and property owners want to be made whole, what can we do to support tenants who have been impacted by the pandemic, who have lost quite a bit of income, who are likely in 12-month leases that have very high rents based on the economy before COVID hit? So what can we be working on now as a state and at the federal level to provide resources for both tenants and property owners so that we can avoid an evictions crisis?
I'd like to hear from you too on this, Brian. The governor's executive orders, the moratorium, what it says property owners can and cannot do during this crisis.
Yeah, the Emergency Order 24 that Elliot just talked about modified Emergency Order 4 and opened up the door for landlords to be able to process evictions or issue eviction notices with respect to the health and safety. And I have a handful of cases where my landlords have been getting complaints from other tenants of this behavior that's been going on. Because unfortunately, as we all know, people are cooped up and there are some people who are not doing so well being cooped up. It may flare up a mental illness. It may there may be some alcohol consumption going on. So there have been a lot of different instances that have popped up before Emergency Order 24 where the landlords really, they felt their hands were tied and they felt sympathetic to the other tenants who were suffering through this adverse behavior, but there was really nothing other than issuing a warning letter that could be done. The Emergency Order 4 and 24 made it clear that the tenant still has to pay their rent. So at the very beginning, I advocated for my landlords to communicate with their tenants to let them know there was a misperception out there that you don't have to pay your rent. You're going to be forgiven your rent. So I said, communicate with your tenants. And by and large, the landlords have done a good job doing that from my perspective, because I usually hear the things that go sideways. It's been very quiet, to tell you the truth, since the emergency orders came into effect, other than those health and safety issues.
Wow, that's really interesting. So if a tenant, Brian, were causing trouble, and you know, I appreciate you pointing out that, you know, people sometimes behave badly when they're under mental stress and they're all cooped up. So what recourse does a landlord have if a particular tenant is disturbing everybody else?
Well, right now, since Emergency Order 24 came into effect, they're able to start an eviction action. That emergency order came into effect on April 3rd. They're able to do an eviction action, and they can give a seven-day notice. Health and safety and substantial damages are under the statute 540:2, Roman numeral 2, B and D, and those are things that allow a landlord to give a seven-day eviction notice. But as correctly pointed out by Elliot, up until now, the district court, the circuit courts, were not actually docketing those eviction actions. So there are a couple eviction actions that have been filed, but no one has actually received an order. Now, before Emergency Order 24, I sent a letter out to all my landlords saying, this is what you need to do. You need to document the file. You need to take these complaints, do an incident report, then do a warning letter. There's nothing in these emergency orders that keeps the landlords from sending warning letters or infraction notices and trying to do other things in order to curb the behavior. And then there is call the police as well.
So you can get the process started. You just may have to wait a while for it to be finished.
Yes. I mean, in the usual case, taking away the emergency orders, unless somebody's threatening to shoot their neighbor, I usually advocate for the landlord to send a warning letter in advance in any event. So they should still be doing that and then preparing for when they can process an eviction that they're prepared to go forward with incident reports in the file. If there are police reports, they should probably get those police reports. The problem is on some of these emergency matters, they do involve criminal charges that may be pending, and that's difficult because you're not going to get a police report while the criminal charges are pending because the police are
pending, right?
Yeah, preparing the reports. Yeah.
Well, let's go to our listeners, all of you. Lots of people with questions. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Paul's calling in from Durham. Hi, Paul. Thanks for being with us today. Go ahead.
How are you, folks?
Go ahead. Yeah, great.
I have kind of an interesting situation. I'm a landlord in two markets. I'm at the university with 100 beds, and I'm in the town of Portsmouth, city of Portsmouth, with 100 apartments. And it's been very interesting watching these two markets respond to the COVID situation. In Durham, we had UNH administrators make announcements, close the campus, and refund their tenants or their families, their parents, for their campus housing. And in that process, they confused the community, or they confused their housing and policies with private off-campus housing. And I think there's little doubt that the dormitory situation with tight sleeping quarters and group bathing and sanitary facilities are not advantageous under these current COVID conditions. But a quality private apartment in the community of Durham with no shared bedrooms and adequate space, there's no more of a threat to the community than a private home. I was landscaping, raking the yard in Durham one day at one of my facilities, and a Durham resident got right in my face, telling me I was a complete threat to their community.
Wow.
And it really highlighted for me how the message from the university was, I went back and looked at what they were sending out. It was totally inappropriate. I guess I can't express my frustration with the administration and what they did.
Paul, if I could ask you a couple of questions, this is really interesting. And you're right, the dormitories closed down and, you know, parents and students got refunds for that. But there are lots of students who live in private apartments on campus or near campus. One of my kids who's in college actually lives in a private apartment now, and we're paying for an empty apartment because the lease goes till the end of May. So that's the way it is. How are the people who are renting your private apartments in Durham dealing with that? Are they just paying through the end of the lease, or what are you doing there?
We're over 50% occupied.
Still, okay.
A lot of students went home initially, and they were kind of frustrated being at home. The classes are still being offered online. They came back to Durham to utilize their apartments. We've had no sign of any outbreaks in our community, and I'm sure the kids have learned, like the rest of us, how to manage yourself under these conditions. And they're doing their online studies from their apartments in Durham. And we've received some interesting phone calls, emails, and correspondence from families that think that we're part of the university, and that whatever
right.
the university says.
Sure.
Applies to this situation. So.
Well, Paul, it's good to hear from you in a very interesting situation, given that you're renting to students and there's been a lot of upheaval there. So thank you for calling in. Coming up, we will take more of your questions and comments. We'd love to hear your stories about this. Also, we'll talk to an advocate for apartment building owners. He'll give us his perspective. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, landlord-tenant rights. What's changed recently in rental housing? What the regulations, recommendations, and legal rights are for both property owners and renters? And Exchange listeners, let's hear your questions. If you're a tenant concerned about paying rent, or if you're a landlord worried about your own income or the safety of your property, send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Joining us now on the phone is Nick Norman. He's Director of Legislative Affairs for the Apartment Association of New Hampshire. And Nick Norman, really good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
What are the biggest concerns, Nick, that you're hearing from your landlord members and property managers about all this?
there's concerns after concerns after concerns.
It goes on
and on.
Yeah.
So one of the main things that comes up is that the orders that are out in New Hampshire, the emergency orders that have been correctly portrayed so far, is that there's nothing in the orders that says a tenant has to pay their rent. They said it does say they should be paying their rent, but there's no consequence if they're not. Maybe down line there's going to be an eviction if they're not. But what's happening in a number of cases is that tenants are receiving stimulus money, and in some cases more income than they used to have, and they're choosing not to pay their rent because they cannot be evicted at the moment for non-payment. So that's a great concern. Another big concern is that if you're in the real estate industry, you know that small claims is fairly well useless and ineffective. And it's very common that a tenant leaves owing money and the landlord never collects on that. So there's a great concern that towards the end of this, what's going to happen is tenants will not have paid for several months. The landlord's out that money, yet the landlord who may have gotten a temporary stay of forbearance on eviction or foreclosure or paying taxes or other expenses, all that expense has to be caught up. That's not free money. That's just delayed. And meanwhile, the landlord's going to be out the rent that has been paid.
Yeah. Sounds like you have a frustration, Nick, with the moratoriums and the rules that have come out recently. You seem to say there's not enough accountability that renters have to pay.
Right. And that the original intent that the governor said was to protect tenants that can't afford to pay rent due to the COVID-19 situation. But that's not what his orders put out. His orders stopped all evictions originally. And then through conversation with him, they did open up health, safety, substantial damage, and abandonment, by the way.
Sure. Yeah. And we talked about that in the last segment, how when the order came out and then it was modified for some of those reasons. You also seem to be saying, Nick, that small claims court, you know, is unreliable, that, yeah, you could try to go there and get some money for someone who leaves you holding the bag, but the chances of getting your money are not good.
The chances are very, very slim. The low percentage of small claims cases end up in actual payments to the plaintiff, the person. So,
yeah, go ahead, Nick. I apologize. Go ahead.
That's it. You got it.
Lots of phone lines, and we're all working remotely today. So how much extra costs, Nick, have landlords seen from this in terms of cleaning and sanitizing and so forth?
So there's some extra costs. But the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is that because of the pandemic that we're in, there's less maintenance. So properties are going to have much more deferred maintenance because there's not enough money to do the maintenance to begin with. Secondly, it's a health risk for maintenance people to be going into apartments. So less people want to work. We have a situation where we have a heat system that needs to be replaced. We could not get the plumbers to go and do the job.
That's interesting. So other guests have talked about sort of a tsunami of events that are building up. And you're describing another tsunami, possibly, Nick, of deferred maintenance. People just aren't going into these properties to fix them right now. So in the end, the boilers will break and the sinks will leak.
That's exactly right. Lead abatement work is not being done. If we don't have rents coming in, landlords won't be able to pay their tax bills, their commercial or standard mortgages, their utilities, their insurance. Plumbers, handymen, painters going without work or not being paid. There's a huge financial impact that could be very devastating. And many people don't realize that property owners usually operate on a very slim margin. There's not much money left over at the end of the month after you pay all your bills and your maintenance.
How are you advising your landlord members to alert tenants if there is a case of COVID-19 in the building? Brian talked about this earlier, but it's very tricky. What's your understanding of the responsibility of the landlord, Nick, if someone in the building does have COVID-19?
Yeah, I don't think that I could add anything to what Brian captured. Brian is very knowledgeable on that, and he portrayed it quite well. There is no guidance. As Brian said, there is no guidance.
What do you think the impact will be, Nick, of all of this? And you've talked about a lot, as have our other guests. What's going to be the impact on the rental market in the long run? New Hampshire, as you know, already had a severe shortage of rental properties.
Well, almost everything that happens that the government puts out regulations on ends up in increased rent. So here you have more expenses, more money being lost. That has to be caught up. So you're likely to see, again, a push for higher rent.
Is anybody even moving right now, Nick, or is everybody just pretty much staying put? I was trying to put myself in the shoes of a landlord, and I was thinking, how would I even show an apartment? So what's happening with movement?
Yeah, I can definitely talk to that. So life happens. People still need to move for various reasons. And as normal, tenants are leaving apartments as they would normally as life changes. Maybe a little bit less than normal, but they're still leaving. And the big question that many landlords ask, and I've heard it several times, we go through it ourselves, they say, okay, so I've got an apartment that's vacant, and we've painted and renovated it, and it's ready to go. Should I rent it? It's a big question. Many landlords are choosing not to rent their apartments because of the orders and the situation that's at hand. So now we're going to have even lower supply, higher demand, again, pushing up rent prices.
So you think we might even have less rental properties once this is all over, even though we were practically down to zero vacancy rates in some communities, Nick?
I think that we already have less rental properties. Wow. In my company, we have three people moving, and we're not moving to get them re-rented because of the concerns that we have. If we do rent it, then what? These orders make it so that landlords don't want to rent their properties. I can't say that's true for everybody, but I can say that for many, that's the case.
Anything else, Nick, that you want the general public just to understand about how apartment owners are feeling right now?
So many times it comes out in media or in conversations with government orders that landlords are portrayed as a villain. They're portrayed as the bad guy. And I can tell you that in my 32 years of managing, I've never met a bad landlord. All the landlords that we know and work with are very concerned to keep their tenants safe. They always work out payment plans with their tenants to get caught up. They're good members of society and an important part of having a healthy economy.
Well,
there's
Nick,
one
Nick,
other point.
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
It's extremely important, and it's not the direct subject to this call, but I think it's important for everyone to realize that we, the people here, not the government, but the people of the public, can stop the pandemic. And that's what we need to do.
By staying at home?
Stop the pandemic. We can stay at home. We can wear a face mask when we're in public. We can be very, very cautious about touch surfaces and hand sanitation. We can get a HEPA air filter for our home. There's many things that we can do that will completely stop the pandemic, regardless of what government stuff is happening and what the economy is doing. And that will solve all of our problems.
Well, and we've definitely talked about all those health precautions on this show, gosh, probably three or four times a week. So I hear you on that. Nick, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Welcome.
That's Nick Norman. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Apartment Association of New Hampshire. Again, we invite your stories, your concerns. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour, Brian Shaughnessy. He's an attorney who works in landlord-tenant disputes. Elliot Berry, managing attorney with New Hampshire Legal Assistance. And Alyssa Margolin, Director of Housing Action NH, a coalition of property owners and tenants groups who work to increase the affordable housing supply in the Granite State. And Alyssa, toward that note, wow, what did you think about Nick saying, look, it's just with the restrictions and the inability to do maintenance and all the concerns, people are going to just take properties off the market. What do you think, Alyssa?
I thought Nick raised a number of important issues, and the supply of rental housing was one of them. As you know, because you've covered this issue on your show so well, Laura, We had a really low vacancy rate in our state. A healthy vacancy rate is considered somewhere between 5% and 7%, and we are below 1%, and in some communities, there's virtually no rental housing available. As many have said, we have a supply side problem, and it's quite possible that this pandemic will exacerbate that, and that's really concerning. In addition, if 2009 is any indication, foreclosures play into the supply of rental housing as well. So in 2009, when we had a foreclosure crisis in our state, we saw 45,000 residents move out of homeownership and into the rental market. And the rental market became really crowded. So while prices for homeownership had dropped, rental housing skyrocketed. And so if we're going to see a drop in supply even more, although it's hard to even imagine a tighter market than we have, I think we can see increased prices and also a heavily burdened tenant population really struggling to make these expensive rents. The last residential rental cost survey that's done by New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority had our median rent close to $1,400 a month. That's a salary of about $54,000 a year. So these are all, if we're going to look at the big picture of all this, and I think Nick made another great point about property owners having to pay their taxes, having to provide for capital improvements and maintenance. We can't just nurture one side or the other. We have to make sure that we're looking at this holistically.
Well, and Elliot, Nick seemed to also say, though, that some of the actions taken by government, meaning the moratoriums and so forth, were making landlords not feeling good about keeping their properties open for rent. So I wonder what you think about that, Elliot.
Yeah, a couple things, Laura. First of all, it's really important that your listeners know, and maybe some small landlords in particular don't know, that the federal government is really pushing forbearance relief for owners of four units or less in a building. If they have any federal involvement in mortgage insurance or mortgage subsidy, anything a home owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, they are entitled to 180-day forbearance that can be extended for another 180 days. For larger landlords, the forbearance periods are shorter, but the feds are offering some significant relief there. But the other thing I wanted to respond to, of course, this is really hard, but it's a major public health problem. If you're going to evict somebody in this crisis, the homeless shelters aren't taking new people. They're trying to thin their population. So as a matter of public health, that I'm sure Governor Sununu wasn't wild about doing this. He certainly isn't anti-landlord. The issue is we're all tightening belts and living in extremely difficult circumstances because of a major public health problem. And then the other thing I wanted to respond to about tenants not having, there's no accountability if they don't pay their rent. The accountability is that when this thing is over, they're going to be evicted and they're not going to be able to rent a new place because their last place they were they lived in, they were evicted for non-payment of rent. And the word gets out, landlords track eviction activity. It's going to be incredibly difficult for people who don't pay their rent to find new housing, and that is a very serious consequence. Having said that, again, I'll repeat what I said at the beginning. I think the most important thing that landlords and tenants can do is get together and talk about how they're going to dig their way out through partial payments and longer-term repayment agreements.
You know, we got a note from Maura on Facebook that I think I'll throw to you, Elliot. Maura says, once unemployment has caught up with applications and everyone laid off due to COVID is getting a minimum of $768 a week, which is more than many people made while working, Maura says, we won't need eviction protections, right? Maura says, there'd be no reason someone couldn't pay their rent. Actually, Alyssa, I'll throw this to you because Nick also mentioned some people are getting stimulus checks, which might be more than they were making. So what about on that end, Alyssa, given the unemployment insurance and how that's been stepped up, given the stimulus checks, is there a case to be made that people could afford their rent?
I think your show's covered this as well. If you talk with folks about those who have qualified for unemployment, many folks have not received that yet. So they're experiencing financial strain right now. There's a real kind of economic fragility going on. So they might find themselves in a couple of months owing several months of back rent. And it's very hard to find supports to pay back rent. So we need to look really closely at policies and work with local welfare to make sure that that these resources are available to pay back rent as well. We need flexibility, as Elliot said, to renegotiate agreements so that we can make property owners whole, but we also have an understanding of what tenants are experiencing economically. As we just discussed, rents are already very high, and 50% of tenants before this crisis were already paying too much for rent, right? If 30%, as you noted, is the right amount, we already know that half of them were paying over 50%, and in many cases, you know, some really almost all of their income towards their housing costs. This isn't good for housing, it's not good for tenants, and it's not good for the overall economy because you don't have money to spend in other places if you're putting it all in one place.
Sure, and we won't talk about this now, but one of the issues that's come up on earlier shows in the exchange is that really because landlords are charging too much, or is it because people aren't making enough? But I'm going to set that aside for now because that's a living wage conversation, which we have definitely had on this show before and will again. I want to take another call, though, all of you. This is Chris in Nashua calling in. Hi, Chris, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Laura. Thank you. Wonderful show as usual. Very, very, very needed. I have an idea. Ultimately, per what the guests were just saying, ultimately we need a plan for how we're going to get to the end. We can't keep talking about moratoriums and saying, well, you know, I don't have the money and, you know, I need the money sort of stuff. The way I envision is that we could create some kind of a limited financial reorganization plan for renters so that one third of the rent, total rent that they're going to owe at the end of this period, whenever that is, they will still owe, and they'll have to work out a repayment plan with the landlord, and then the remaining two-thirds of that could be written off subject to proper discharge of the one-third debt that they owe to the landlord, and it won't affect their record unless, of course, they do skip out on that debt, and then it becomes a full bankruptcy or full, you know, debt owed. For the landlord, what I would envision is that they're going to have to take some kind of a haircut because that just comes with being in business. You just have to expect, you know, there is the possibility of loss, so some small portion they're going to have to just write off as a loss, you know, as they normally would. You know, that one third they're going to get from the tenant, hopefully. The rest of that they could either, let's say, finance or get some kind of a tax credit that runs with the property so that it could become a more attractive investment if they decide they have to sell.
So, well, thank you
and
for
of course,
calling,
the banks
Chris.
Will be taken care of.
Yeah, and you've thought a lot about this. And Brian, what do you think?
Well, I'm not sure many of the landlords are going to be interested in taking a haircut, but as I said before, a lot of the landlords are getting some relief on their mortgages. I mean, right away, some of the bigger banks were willing to have forbearance for up to 3 months and just tack it on the end of the loan. That gives the landlords a little bit more flexibility, if you will. They still have their taxes. They still have the maintenance or whatnot. But what I want to point out what is going to happen, and Elliot and I have talked about this in other forums, is at the end of the day, I'm going to be encouraging landlords to enter into payment agreements that are available under the state statute, the eviction statute, 540.13(c)(2), which allows them to enter into what I call a pay and stay. And a pay and stay is a win-win for both landlord and tenant. It allows the tenant to pay the back rent over a period of time, and you can put that out for 6 months to a year because, as Nick Norman pointed out, if you have to go to small claims court, you may never see that money. But if you're able to give them a long-term agreement to stay in their apartment, most tenants don't want to move for good reason. It's their home. And it gives them the ability to make those back payments, but they have to keep current on their current payments. So if you go out of 6 months to a year, it's not a big deal to wait. They're still paying their current rent. You can enter that with the court. You don't have to go back to court if they don't pay. So that is the tool that both Elliot and I, on both sides of the fence, for the landlords and the tenants, will be advocating as this come out. And I think as these unemployment checks come through, that's going to give us that fuel to do those agreements. But we can't forget, there's a lot of people out there that are not on the payrolls. For whatever reason, they're getting paid under the table, or maybe some people are receiving tips that really wasn't calculated into their real wages that are reported to unemployment. So there are folks out there that aren't going to get these resources of unemployment, and we have to be able to keep them in place and show to the landlord, hey, it's in your incentive, rather than to turn this over to somebody else, why don't we work with this tenant?
Okay, and I'm glad you mentioned unemployment, because actually coming up at 1 o'clock today, a special exchange hosted by Peter Biello, and they're going to be talking specifically about that. So that, if you have questions about that, definitely join NHPR at 1 o'clock for that special program. Right now, though, we will take a quick break, and when we come back, more of your emails and calls about all the changes we've seen around landlord and tenant rights and relations. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire landlords and tenants, how the regulations and legal rights have changed, and what happens when they go back to sort of normal. Exchange listeners, whether you're a renter or landlord, tell us how you've been navigating this. Give us your questions and comments. You can send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Brian Shaughnessy, Elliot Berry, Alyssa Margolin, let's go right back to our listeners. And Sarah writes in, she says, I'm sorry, but I don't feel bad for apartment owners. They make their money solely because they can afford to get a mortgage, then rent out those properties to generally lower income groups who indirectly pay that mortgage for them, and also enough for the landlord to profit. That's not labor. That's not working. That's profiting off a class of people who can't afford to buy homes. Sarah says, as for this discussion, yeah, it isn't ideal for landlords, but some people on this show are making it sound like renters are to blame. Talk about class war, Sarah says. People are getting a stimulus after weeks without work, are paying down their bills in order of priority. They are not just intentionally eating bonbons and deciding not to pay rent. Sarah, thank you very much. And Elliot, what do you think about this?
Well, we could talk a long time about it. I think there are a lot of smaller landlords, especially in New Hampshire, who don't own a lot of property and probably don't have a big profit margin. And I understand their need to have cash flow. I do believe also and agree with her that most tenants are in a position where they're struggling like mad to pay rents that are that they can't afford, and they're trying very hard to do it, and they are ultimately paying the landlord's expenses. That's the way the market works. I wish there was a lot more federally assisted housing so that people could pay rent based on their ability to pay, but there's not nearly enough of that. In the meantime, though, I think both landlords and tenants generally are trying to make it a win-win situation. The tenants pay when they possibly can, and the landlords will work with them most of the time.
Well, and there's all different types of landlords. One of my colleagues rents the upstairs of her home to help her pay the mortgage, so it isn't just people sort of profiting off the backs of others. But Brian, what do you think about Sarah's depiction of landlords, especially during this time?
I'm not sure that I think it's fair to the landlords to say that they didn't work to build up the capital necessary to invest in something. And as Elliot pointed out, some of the landlords out there, it may be a three-family that they used to live in and they moved out, and that's really a significant asset. There's a lot of sweat equity that goes into that. I don't like to get into the class warfare type of this. The landlords provide a very essential service to provide the housing stock. And I remind my landlords when they start complaining about these regulations, I say, listen, you're in a regulated industry, so please know the rules before you start complaining. But if you look at the security deposit loan statute out there, it has the preamble that says that a supply of housing is essential for the state of New Hampshire's economic well-being. So the landlords are providing an essential service in putting their capital on the line in order to create housing. Now, I do not represent many slumlords, as the term is out there. I believe many of the landlords that I represent are in New Hampshire want to do the right thing, and they do get on top of repairs. So I don't really look at it as a class thing. I know many of the professionals who are my colleagues, they prefer to rent just because they don't want to have to deal with it. So I would, you know, push back on that distinction between a landlord and a tenant, being one that the landlords really don't need the money or haven't really worked for it.
Well, and here's an important email from Michelle in Keene, who says, my landlord is selling my building. What are my rights and responsibilities regarding potential purchasers, inspectors, real estate agents, etc.? Do I have to allow all these people into my apartment? Can I request several people view the property on the same day? Michelle says, I am in a high-risk group and staying away from everyone, including my family. And I'm assuming Michelle means high-risk to coronavirus. Wow, Michelle, first of all, that's very disruptive for you, and I'm really sorry to hear about that. Elliot, what rights does she have? The landlord's selling the building. That's his or her right, but there's Michelle. She doesn't want all these people, you know, trooping into her apartment.
No, that's right. And in normal times, tenants are obligated to allow landlords reasonable access at reasonable times with prior notice for any purpose normally associated with rental property. Having said that, given the virus, I do think that courts would rule that in many cases, a tenant would have a right to refuse entry during this period, because especially where you have people who are particularly vulnerable occupying the premises. Again, that's unusual. I would say most of the time, tenants have to cooperate again landlords to show the property at reasonable times after reasonable notice. But in these circumstances, I think it's quite different.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get one more call in. This is Paul in Manchester. Hi, Paul. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
I overheard talking about you know, with the mortgages and stuff, how they might have to raise the rents. And where I live now, I have to take my rent out of my disability, which doesn't leave me very much to begin with.
Wow.
And, like, I got stuff sitting over at the pharmacy I can't even pick up because I can't afford it. I don't even know if I'm even qualified to get the stimulus because I never got it. I'm really frustrated.
Wow, Paul. Yeah. How much is your rent, Paul, if I may ask?
$889 a month.
And you pay out of your...
Yeah, I only get $1,151 a month for disability.
Phew, that doesn't leave a lot left over. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. I mean, well, I'm constantly overdrawn at the bank. And I mean, I'm really at my wit's end now. And I just don't know which way to turn anymore.
Paul, I'm really glad you called, and I feel awful letting you go, but we're towards the end of the show. But I do want to go to Elliot Berry, maybe. We're going to get your contact info, Paul, because we might be able to set you up with some assistance. But Elliot, your thoughts for Paul, you know, $880 a month for rent and like $1,100 or $1,200 his total income.
It's heartbreaking to hear and heartbreaking for me to say that this is a situation that thousands of New Hampshire tenants, especially elderly and disabled tenants, are facing. Notwithstanding my determined efforts, there is no limit today on what a landlord can charge. It really isn't totally dictated by the market. And so when you have people on fixed incomes and a terrible shortage of housing at reasonable prices, they're going to end up having to pay ridiculously high percentage of their income for rent, and it's not sustainable. And the only thing we can do, I mean, thank goodness there is a Section 8 program where people can get vouchers, but the wait lists are tremendous. And then there's privately owned, federally subsidized housing and public housing, but they're all, you know, where the tenants' rent is based on 30% of their income. But the problem is, again, the wait lists are very, very long. But the first thing I would urge Paul to do is to contact the Manchester Housing Authority and get on the wait list so that at some point he can get an affordable rent. But the market conditions are horrendous.
Well, all of you, we will wrap it up there. And I really appreciate everyone being with us. Elliot Barrett, it was good to talk to you today. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thank you, Laura.
That's Elliot Barry, managing attorney with New Hampshire Legal Assistance. Alyssa Margolin, good to have you too. Thank you for your time. We'll talk again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Alyssa Margolin, director of Housing Action NH. And Brian Shaughnessy, it was good to have you too. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That's Brian Shaughnessy. He's an attorney who works in landlord-tenant disputes and is president of the New Hampshire Bar Association's Pro Bono Program. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.